Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. And we are speaking with Joseph Cotto, the author of a new book. I really love this first book that was showing the Native American reality and the interaction in Florida that has happened with the people who were conquering America. And he comes with a second book in the exact same style and just as good, Eye for an Eye, a true story of life, liberty, murder, and the pursuit of revenge at the birth of America. And it's available on Amazon. I have just put the link in the regular chat, and it will be in the description at the end of the show also. Joseph Cotto, how are you doing?
Doing well, JF, even though my camera is very wobbly, I am doing well. And I'm really glad that you like my new book. I mean, it's a great honor, obviously. And I'm also glad that you like the previous one.
Yes, I've seen the wobble in your camera combined with the wobble of the fan above your head, which reminds us that Florida is a state of heat. And this is the state that had to be conquered. At great cost, at great human cost, and there was no Disney back in the days where you are describing.
Absolutely not. It was really basically every man for himself. Even if you were with a group, as people who will read the book will know, members of the group turned on each other. So a lot of folks had a really, really nasty time, even though they believed strongly enough in what they were doing in the New World to tough it out as much as possible.
I really like the story you tell. I mean, we can get in the detail, but in general, the reason I like it is you show what human nature is at the border of survival. And we don't get to see this in the modern world, what people do when they're at the border of survival. What happens with loyalty when your boss is threatening your life? What happens with your loyalty when your general makes decisions that will inevitably lead you to die for a cause, and most human beings don't want to die for a cause. So it ends up with all sorts of anarchic reversals and people becoming pirates, because back in those days, people were so at the border of survival in America with all of the sets of interest on the Native American, French, Spanish side, that you end up having a lot of people who are simply not loyal to the crown or to the missions they were here for.
Absolutely correct. And, you know, it goes to show that human nature is something very difficult. A lot of people want it to be something, you know, simple. A lot of people like to think humans are inherently good. I think that's, you know, a little absurd, especially considering that the definition of good is subjective. Other people like to think human beings are inherently evil, nasty, predatory, but that's, you know, quite off as well. I would say that in the book, what I do is give a pretty good assessment of how human beings act when they are under the gun, and when at the same time they really believe that they're creating something new for humanity going forward. So essentially, I tell the story of these French settlers of Florida who were innovators that wanted to create a society quite different than anything that had come before, where they could live as Frenchmen and women in the New World, and at the same time not try to convert the natives or force them to be anything they're not. They really wanted to have a system of decentralization where you had the natives with their own kingdoms, the French with their kingdom, and everyone sort of living in relative peace, united by commerce along the St. John's River in Florida. You could say that these French settlers were actually quite libertarian in their outlook, even though libertarianism by no means had come along yet.
Yeah, and that's my favorite part of the book. You have to reach the end to get there, but it's fascinating because it's a daring theory, this idea that these French early colonialists of Florida were basically the proto-Americans in a way. They were the proto-founders, not just because they were there physically, but they imbued America with a sort of libertarian attitude that later made it into the Constitution, although not directly. But the spirit was there.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of people who perhaps, you know, most people have no idea about the history we're talking about, they definitely will want to take a look at it because, as I write in the end of the book, they were the original American dreamers, these French settlers of Florida. And they have not gotten their due, which is a terrible, terrible shame. Although I hope my book goes some way in giving them at least a little bit of the historical credit they deserve.
And the reason you developed this theory, and I know we're putting the cart before the horses here because we haven't talked about the history yet, but the reason you reached this conclusion is their attitude with respect to Native Americans, where you had the Spanish settlers stealing, being dishonest toward the Native Americans, at times raping their woman. And you didn't have this with the French settlers. They were either teaming up or at times kind of in a friction, but they were men of their words toward Native Americans when they committed to something.
They were. And it's interesting because they got into some issues with the American Indians because basically they were allies. And sometimes it happens that when people are allied with each other, they still have friction. And it was just this sort of, you know, very petty thing. And the problems, you know, the small problems, not like problems that cause war, came from the French, who basically wanted to see what kind of riches were on the land. They didn't plant the crops they should have to survive. The American Indians were extremely helpful, but the French wanted to explore as many lands as possible to engage in commerce with the Indians, but also, you know, to see what natural resources were there, namely gold and silver. And that a lot of the Indians, as time wore on, got a little tired of this. But all the same, the French never triggered the American Indian into, you know, a state of war or anything close to that. As a matter of fact, the American Indians, once the French were defeated by the Spanish, they mourned the loss of the French as, you know, strong allies, because the Spanish, in comparison, were absolutely horrendous.
Absolutely. And one thing I retain from your book is that the French that you describe, okay, they brought a great spirit of liberty, at least with respect to how they were treating Native Americans, to America, but they died. They lost. The kind people lost, and they are eliminated. They don't exist. I had never even heard of those people, the Huguenots, as you call them. So the gentle libertarian people lost to more harsh, more violent humans. And the proto-libertarianism of the French, may I suggest that we can even extend this to their death and say that the proto-death of the French will be the proto-death, will be eventually the death of America as a land of liberty.
Absolutely correct. It's something that a lot of people don't want to admit. But in many ways, the story that I relate here is something that obviously tells, you know, the facts of the past, but it has a tremendous deal of insight for our present and the future, particularly men and women of the West in the New World, and the issues in the book in terms of how people in the New World interact with, you know, natives, in terms of how people in the New World interact with each other. It's really, really something important, and I think that folks could benefit greatly from reading it, not only in terms of, you know, learning an extremely important facet of history, but they would have a lot of insight on what's going on today and what's likely to happen in the future.
All right, so let's talk about the details of this fascinating history, the Huguenot people. It's stunning because I didn't even know that existed. A bunch of French people who somehow made it their life's priority to become Protestants, like the English. Traitors.
They were thought of as such by the French Catholic establishment. A lot of the people, the French who became Huguenots, were very educated people, obviously well-to-do, noblemen, who decided one day that the Catholic Church had been deceiving them, and that the basically the theocracy, which is in France at the time, was not serving their perception of God or humans. And so they said, screw it, we're going to adopt these new views of Lutheranism as described by John Calvin. So they were Calvinists. And in the West, we would know, well, in the New World, especially the New World influenced by the British, we would know them as Presbyterians. That's what Calvinism would be called in Canada and the U.S. So it's really an interesting, these people have such an interesting story, and they suffer tremendously for it. But basically, their crime was to want to live a life of self-sufficiency, alone, away from other people, where they could be themselves. They were not out to screw others over. They wanted to, you know, give everyone their space. And they had a very strong concept of individual rights and liberties. And they really were blazing the trail for those of us who care about personal freedom.
And so I can't help but think that they have self-selected into this religious sect, as it would be described in France then, but they have self-selected perhaps in the very same way the English, who have colonized America eventually, have also self-selected. Perhaps Protestantism attracts then the personality that likes entrepreneurship, that likes liberty, self-sufficiency, farming attitude, this kind of neo-evangelical, I interpret the Bible type of stubbornness, if you will, instead of choosing the religious authority of the Pope.
Absolutely. And of course, they were still French. They enjoyed fine wine, cheeses, all that good stuff, food with heavy cream. They didn't give up being French at all in their eyes, but they believed that their society needed to change because it had become something based upon lies and oppression. And that sounds a lot like wokeness. It's because it is. If you see what happened with the Roman Catholic Church in Spain, especially in Spain, obviously targeted these Huguenots soon enough, it's like it's like proposition nationalism in the West today, where the country is not based upon a people, a bloodline, it's based in a culture, it's based upon a set of abstract ideas. And nowadays, it's, you know, a slew of things. I won't even get into it here. But back then in Spain, it was Roman Catholicism. And so the Spaniards were willing to accept people who are not European into their society as long as they embrace this religion. But they also believed that anyone in their midst had to embrace the religion, lest these people be a problem. So the Spaniards did not have a sense of in-group solidarity with their fellow Europeans. And that explains why they were so brutal to them in the New World, whereas these people were absolute minorities, totally outnumbered by the American Indians.
Absolutely. And I found myself while reading your book wondering, how did the Huguenot treat trans people? Did they use their preferred pronouns?
They probably would have been hanged back then.
And yet this is a libertarian people by the standards of the time. So the Huguenot were persecuted in France, but something that wasn't clear to me, they were persecuted and genocided in France, and yet they were in America on the order of the king?
Mm-hmm. The king, along with someone named Gaspard de Coligny, he was a very prominent and wealthy Huguenot nobleman. Coligny went to the king and said, you know, it's not working out here in France between the Protestants and the Catholics. It's good to have distance. And the king agreed. And so they tried to find a part of the world where French Protestants could go. They initially chose Brazil, but that was ruled by Portugal at the time, which is, of course, a Catholic empire, but more tolerant than Spain. And eventually the colony failed there. There were religious tensions. People thought, you know, it's best that we just leave. And then there were wars of religion going on in Europe. But eventually, Coligny compelled the king to allow him to have another shot at colonization. And it turned out to be that the colonization took place along the eastern seaboard of what's now the United States. Now, the Spanish had, quote unquote, discovered Florida not too long before, and they claimed the eastern seaboard as their own, not just what's now Florida. But by the time there was this Huguenot colonization of Florida, as well as initially what's now South Carolina, that didn't last. But the colony really took root in what's now Jacksonville, which is the largest city in Florida. By that time, the Spanish had been thoroughly defeated in Florida. They came to Florida decades before. They wanted to exploit the land for gold and silver. They wanted to convert the natives and take the natives as slaves. And the natives obviously didn't like that. So the Spaniards got routed. I mean, they were literally kicked out of Florida. By the time the French came, there was no one there who was European. So they believed that Spain had given up on Florida, and they felt fine in settling it. And the American Indians were very happy to see them. They liked the idea of white people they could get along with. So everything was cool, even though there were some hiccups. But things really didn't go south until the Spaniards arrived to take revenge upon the French and try to once again subjugate the American Indians.
Absolutely. And it's a repeating term many times in this story. You end up having the third player. Let's say that the first two players are French and Spanish, but the third player of the Native American, based on how much he hates one side or another, determines the vanquisher, determines who ends up winning.
Absolutely. And also the English played a role because they showed up one day looking for fresh water and they wound up giving the French some much needed foodstuffs to, you know, the French by that time, this was close to when they were giving up and wanting to return home. But the English gave them a bit of, quite a bit, as a matter of fact, of support. So the English played a role, but mostly it was the American Indians, along with, of course, the Spanish and the French. And it, you know, this whole thing is fascinating for too many reasons to even begin to count here, but chief among them being that a lot of people think of the U.S. as being someplace founded by Britain, and most of its colonies were, there's no question. But the original European permanent civilian settlement in America was in Florida, what's now Florida. And it gets totally overlooked in favor of, you know, something that came along much later, Jamestown and Virginia and all this stuff. But the European diversity of early America is fascinating. It wasn't all, you know, British people forming a colony. You had obviously the French and the Spanish and the English were just sort of like a very peripheral presence. And then of course the American Indians who were there before. So it's really interesting, the history of early America. It is sort of like a hybrid of the most powerful countries of Western Europe, which definitely is, I think, something deeply enriching about the history of the East, of the Eastern Seaboard, particularly Florida. But today, a lot of people don't want to focus on that. It's more fashionable to just talk about the 1619 project.
Yes, and as a French person in my history classes in elementary school, we learned that initially the French were dominating over the entire East Coast down to Florida, and that we lost these parts to a war with the English. So definitely it's in our history books that we were there. So the Huguenots, they found themselves in Florida. They established there. And you find the main character of this part of your book is René de la Donnière, I think. And yep. This guy finds himself faced with so much random illness and things that strike him and attacks and misplanned various things, including the fact that his people are easily swayed by basically salesman behavior. They easily get convinced, yep. Hey, you have to leave this place and you have to go look for gold or look for piracy opportunities there. And he loses a lot of his men through this kind of persuasion.
Absolutely. The quest for easy money was something that really played a big role in the Huguenots deteriorating even before the Spanish got there. A lot of these French settlers were angry that, you know, basically there weren't just mounds of gold popping up out of the ground. And eventually they did get some silver from the American Indians, but a lot of them wanted more. So eventually a French pirate ship came to them and said, you know, this guy who's leading you is basically a moron. If you overthrow him, we could use your resources to go down to the Caribbean and make a real living looting. And some people did wind up going along with these pirates. But what happened was that the Spanish, who controlled the Caribbean at that time, they killed most of these pirates, and only a few survived. And the ones that did made it back to, where else did they have to go? To Fort Caroline in Jacksonville. And some of them were put to death by Laudonnière. And so it's a fascinating story. I mean, this is something about human nature, people not wanting to look at the long run, being focused on the short term. And you can see just how badly it turned out for these Huguenots.
And I love how René de la Naudière De La Donière reports on this because he seems so naive, but he pursues the order of his king, and he's been told, go there and don't annoy the Spaniards. And so he's very annoyed that his men are leaving him to go annoy the Spaniards and go do some piracy. Well, I said the Spaniard, but really to do random piracy here and there, because he's worried that it will come back to haunt him and that eventually exactly. people will consider that he's responsible for these men.
Absolutely. And the Spanish thought he, under their law, they held him as being a pirate anyway, because they thought he was camping on their ground and taking their natural resources, even though they had given up on Florida. The story of Spain is rather bizarre here, because they were in an extreme state of mind. That's a good way of putting it, since they had just become liberated from the Northern African Muslims who ruled over them. And Spain is unique in that, unlike, say, France, it's a place that does not have much ethnic unity. In the south, you'll see a lot of people who look very North African because they have a lot of Moorish heritage. In the north, you'll find people who are Celtic. If you head over toward the east, you'll see people who look more generally Mediterranean, similar to people from the south of France. It's really fascinating. So Spain didn't have a common language. It didn't have a common culture. It only had a desire to be rid of the Islamic rule. And so religion was what was used to unify Spain. And as a result of that, the Spaniards, you know, wanted to control as much of the world as they could. They were looking to prove themselves. They were embarrassed, really, by having been ruled over by these Muslims from another continent. And all these things and more contributed to a state of mind among them of totalitarianism. That's a good way of putting it. And this included, and it's something I address in the book, they took fellow Europeans as slaves. And as a matter of fact, someone who eventually sought revenge on them for the destruction of French Florida was an emancipated slave who was a French Catholic nobleman that was taken prisoner by the Spanish and made to work as a slave. So the Spanish had an extreme state of mind. It wasn't that they were out to promote, despite what we would hear today, white supremacy or whatnot. They treated their fellow whites like garbage, and they would treat American Indians or blacks or whomever in a preferential manner to their fellow Europeans if they, you know, observe the quote unquote right religion. So it's seeing how these people, the Spaniards, interact with the world around them. I mean, it's fascinating just because you see these such a bizarre turn of events, but it's also fascinating because it really lets you know that the ideas of history that a lot of people have today, where all these whites got together to basically put the screws to non-whites from day one in America, it's just not true. This book deals with whites absolutely destroying each other, despite them being a minority in the New World, and destroying each other for the most absurd of reasons.
Absolutely. As a reminder to our crowd, if you have a question or you would like to support the show, use the Odyssey Super Chats. Odyssey Super Chats are my favorite platform for supporting the show. And alternatively, if you don't like Odyssey, you can also join us on Entropy. The Entropy link is in the description below. One of the little red pills that you drop in this book is the conception that the Spanish had their slaves and had their black slaves then in Florida, way before it is considered that the white men would have brought slaves to America, way before 1619.
Way before. What happened was that the Spanish came to Florida. They soon after destroyed the French colony, and the Spanish built their capital south of Jacksonville, and what's now, it's St. Augustine. The Spanish gave it its name. St. Augustine used to be a little Indian town called Siloy, and the Spanish just took it over, cast the Indians out, and built their town. And what the Spanish did was rather bring women, obviously, as the French were doing, to try to, you know, recreate their European society in the New World. They brought sub-Saharan African slaves, and the Spanish men would go with these slave women and then sell their offspring into slavery. And the idea originally was to have these slaves work for their fathers, or, you know, in the case of the women, their partners, whatever, as field hands. But the American Indians were such good warriors that they prevented the Spanish from getting far beyond their little settlement in San Augustine, or the old French fort, which the Spanish obviously took over. So the Spanish were left just to sell their kids into slavery. It was really, they envisioned San Augustine as being this, you know, grand new capital of the new world, where Spain would be revered and feared and this and that. But San Augustine very quickly failed as anything of that nature, and it was overshadowed tremendously by Havana down in Cuba.
And all of these things that you described in the last 10 minutes is why when an audience member of mine asks me in private, "Jeff, I look like a Spanish guy. Am I white?" I answered, "Nah." So the Huguenot find themselves weakened on the French side by all these events of his own countrymen not following the orders anymore, and at times leaving him and putting him in trouble. And then there's a confrontation that happens between the French and the Spanish. And somehow the main character of your story survives by fleeing, basically.
Yeah, what happened was that once the fort was attacked, the French fort was attacked, because the French, who were just about to leave, they were so depleted by this point that they were just had it. They were about to leave in failure, go back to France. New ships arrived, reinforcements came to basically fortify the colony. And it looked like it was going to go well. But it was discovered, thanks to an American Indian who came to visit the fort, that the Spanish were down setting up a new capital in St. Augustine. And the man who led the party of reinforcements was Jean Ribault. And he was the one who originally sailed to Florida before Fort Caroline was set up. Because before the French set up Fort Caroline, as I mentioned, they tried something in South Carolina. Well, before they went to what's now South Carolina, they actually went to the site of their eventual colony and scouted it out. But they thought, no, we'll move on somewhere up north. The fellow who originally saw this for France, discovered the site of Fort Caroline, was Ribault. And he was commissioned by Coligny, who obviously had the support of the king, to set up this new colony. Launer was one of his deputies during this initial voyage to Florida. And Launer was chosen because Ribault eventually became too entangled in European politics. It was Launer who was chosen to actually, you know, try to build something on what's now today Florida. A bit of a complicated history, but there it is. So anyhow, when Ribault arrived with these reinforcements, just as Launer and his friends were ready to set sail, and the Indian told them, you know, there's this big Spanish encampment getting set up, Ribault, who had taken over from Launer as governor of Florida for France, said, "This has to be destroyed." It was getting late in summer, and Launer said, "You know, we really have to be careful about this, because the weather here can be very unpredictable. If you go down there with all of your men, you'll leave the fort undefended if the Spanish should try to attack." But Ribault said he had his orders to destroy the Spaniards if they tried.
And amazingly, you look at these orders, and I read these orders, and I'm like, wait a minute, is that saying that he has to destroy the Spaniard? Because the order from the kings is something along the lines of, make sure you treat the Spaniards as they would treat you, or something like that. And the guy concludes, "I have to go and kill them."
He had a very Gallic French sense of honor, no question about it. he was a hell of a guy, Ribault, but he was too headstrong. He should have listened to Launer, because Launer recognized that if they left for St. Augustine to destroy it, then the fort would be undefended, and the Spanish could come up over land and destroy the fort. And that's exactly what happened. But no, so Ribault went down to St. Augustine with his ships. And just as they were about to enter what's called the Matanzas River, there was a big hurricane. And it just blew them way off course. They eventually became shipwrecked. And the Spanish realized that most of the French fort, Fort Caroline's defenses were gone. So they decided to march in a hurricane over land to attack the fort. And the French at the fort were skeptical that there would be a Spanish attack during a hurricane, but it happened anyway. But although Laudonnière was cautious because he knew how ruthless the Spanish could be. So it was really fascinating how this took place. But the Spanish represented a certain idea about, it's interesting because they mixed certain concepts that we now recognize. They had a proto wokeness of today. They had a proto, diversity is great at any cost perspective. And they also believed that they were imbued with some sort of moral righteousness. But the Spaniards at the same time were people who were not big fans of science. They were not big fans of individual rights and liberties. They were not big fans of what we would now call a form of capitalism. They were just basically exploiters. The French, on the other hand, were very intellectual. They were people who were tolerant, definitely tolerant of others. And they were people who wanted to be left alone, but at the same time, they were highly ethnocentric, much more than the Spanish were. They were people who wanted to recreate their society. They didn't want to, change their society. They thought French society was just fine. And there were also people who believed very strongly that recreating Europe in the New World was something that would eventually be good for millions and millions of people. So, I mean, both the Spanish and the French here combined certain elements of what I think people will now expect to see on the right and the left. But at the same time, neither one certainly was anywhere near progressive by today's standards.
Mm-hmm. And so the Spanish, with the help of the hurricane, succeed at beating the French. Most of them die, I assume. And some of them, though, are saved by a confession that they are Catholic inside their heart. They are not really Huguenot.
Yeah, they are. Well, that's what they said. What happened was that at the fort, they killed most of the people, but some people were able to escape and go out to ships that were down the river, close to the sea, down the river on the sea, because the river meets the sea, not far from the fort, the Atlantic Ocean, obviously. The St. John's River, what the French called the River of May, meets the Atlantic Ocean, not far from the fort. I hope I said that clearly enough. But the French who were shipwrecked, who were going to attack St. Augustine, they were left along what's now Cape Canaveral, which is very far south of St. Augustine and Jacksonville. It's where the famous, it's where the space shuttle goes up, the Space Center. And so they had to take this very long hike north under the beating sun of September. So, they were eventually intercepted by the Spanish, who said that the Spanish gave the impression that they would accept them and surrender as gentlemen. And some of the French refused to believe it. They said, no, forget it. And they somehow left their party and scattered, getting over the intracoastal waterway, because they were marching along an island, a strip of beach. In Florida, the way it works is that there's an island of beach, and then there's the intracoastal waterway, and then there's the mainland. And obviously, they were shipwrecked along the Atlantic coast, so they were walking up an island. But most of the soldiers, some that got back to the mainland, some of them did eventually get back to France. But the soldiers who stayed with Ribault, they decided to accept the Spanish at their word. And what happened was that the Spanish slaughtered them after giving the impression that they would accept their surrender as prisoner of war. And the French were, like I said, these people were noblemen, they were gentlemen, very educated. So to them, if you tell someone as a European gentleman, one to the next, that you will accept, an individual as a prisoner of war, your word was, your honor. But the Spaniards didn't see it that way. Like I said, they had no real conception of like European, high European culture, in-group loyalty on the basis of Europeanness. So they were fine lying in the name of their God, ironically, and then just killing off these people, the French. So some from the French died at the fort, others died that were trying to get back to the fort after they were shipwrecked. But suffice it to say that most, the overwhelming majority of French Florida's colonists were killed by the Spaniards. And, you know, it's interesting looking at Spain, because you see people who are, you know, certainly European, but the way they act is so un-European that it's like, you could tell, as much as they were ashamed of having been ruled by the Northern African Muslims, deep down culturally, they had really become like these people who ruled over them. And to the extent that they did not have a sense of European in-group consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And so the Spaniards slaughtered the French, and that's the end of the story and the end of your book. That's why today, if you go in Florida, people speak Spanish.
It's not, nowhere near the end, but would have been something if it, I mean, if it had ended that way, then I would have been killed for writing the book today. The Spanish really didn't like dissent, and this definitely descends from the line of these medieval Spaniards. But no, what eventually happened was that word reached France, and the king of France had the right to declare war against Spain for this, but he said, no, it's not worth it, basically, because a lot of people in his court were more sympathetic towards Catholic Spain than their fellow French. But even among the French public, which is about 90% Catholic, 10% Protestant, there was great anger over what took place. And one man in particular was moved by this anger. He was a nobleman who fought in service of France, a Catholic, but he was taken prisoner by the Spaniards, and he was made a slave. And so he was made to live several years, this man born to a high, you know, very notable family, as a slave. And eventually he was able to have his emancipation bought. But after that, he, you know, harbored an extreme hatred of Spain. So when he heard about what happened to his fellow French in Florida, he decided to pool all of his money, get money from his brother, and organize a private party to go across the ocean and kill the Spaniards.
He didn't even tell the people involved that they were going to fight for France.
Exactly. He told them that they were going on a commercial expedition. He only told them when they were in the Caribbean what their real mission was. And they agreed to it.
Amazingly, they weren't annoyed. It's like, oh yeah, you deceived us on this big travel, and you really want us to be soldiers against a bunch of people who have successfully killed our French cousins. Let's do it. Let's avenge France.
It was a supremely French action, I'll put it that way. It was stereotypical in a very good sort of way here. But so they decided to go take revenge on the Spaniards. And what happened was that they actually passed by St. Augustine on the way up. And they didn't go to St. Augustine. They wound up anchoring in North Florida, near what's now the Georgian border. And they met up with a bunch of Indians who had just killed a bunch of Spaniards right before they arrived, who were trying to convert them. And the Indians thought that they were Spaniards, but there was one man with them that survived the attack, and he presented himself to the Indians. And once they saw that the French had returned, they were ecstatic. And they asked the French why they ever left, because they were so much better than the Spanish. And so what this nobleman did, his name was Dominique de Gorge, he was very careful with the American Indians, see how receptive they would be about joining him, to go to the old Fort Caroline, which had been renamed by the Spanish and rebuilt as their citadel. And the Indians were absolutely enthralled with going to kill these Spaniards. And so they organized a party that was planned out, the attack, or actually information for it was obtained by a boy whose parents were killed during the assault on the fort, and the Indians adopted him as one of their own. It's an absolutely fascinating story.
A French boy survives the attack and is raised by Indians since then, and now he's part of the crew that will get the revenge attack on the Spaniards?
Exactly. Yep. It's an amazing story. Almost, I mean, almost unbelievable. But
you could make a movie about this, the French revenge. So at least the Americans will stop claiming that all we know what to do is to pull a white flag. We also know how to get proper revenge.
Absolutely. No question about it. And what happened was about as proper of a revenge as someone could ask for. The American Indians and the French, some sailed down. The Indians walked down to St. Augustine, which once again is south of Jacksonville. And they stopped right before they got to, it's kind of hard to describe, but they had the main fort, the Spanish, and then they built two mini forts a few miles away from it, where the river that the fort is on meets the sea. And the Spanish and the Indians attacked these two mini forts before they attacked the main fort. And it was really an outstandingly successful attack. The Spaniards were caught on the north side of the river, which is very wide, the St. John's River. The Spaniards were slaughtered there. The first Spaniard who tried to kill the invaders was impaled by a pike. An American Indian who was so anxious to kill them just ran forward through the gunfire, took a pike and rammed it into this Spaniard. And then obviously the rest of the Spaniards were taken out. And then the American Indians were they hated the Spaniards so much that they did not want to wait for the French to cross the river with them in boats. The Indians just swam across this massive river, and you have to see it. It is a big river. And they then just went up to these Spaniards at the fort, ran through the gunfire and slaughtered them. It's really just a story that defies belief, but it actually happened. And then, of course, the French and the Indians united to take on the main fort, which they did. What happened was that, the Spaniards were decimated there, but De Gourges wasn't through, with destroying the fort. He was unwilling to take prisoners of war. And what he did was he hung the people there, every Spaniard there, and he put out a plaque saying that this is not done. It's not done in malice, on the basis of who these people are. It's done to liars, thieves, and murderers. And so it was a statement of his true intent, but it was also a bit of fun he was having, because the Spanish, when they killed the French, they said, "We're not doing this to French, we're doing this to Lutherans." So De Gourges decided to make a statement of his own, and it was really something else. I mean, it's revenge as revenge could be.
It's fascinating to me because this should be absolutely taught in every history book. You're telling me that a private party, not even with the assent of the crown, has basically destroyed and annihilated, along with kind of Native Americans who are stateless also, they have destroyed a state-backed Spanish entity in Florida.
Absolutely. And they did it. These people who did it weren't even professional soldiers. I mean, certainly some of them had served in the French military, but they were just, seamen who thought they were going to make a lot of money in the Caribbean. And instead, they were makeshift commandos, and they completely destroyed the Spanish fort that was the pride of, the Spanish Empire. And that was the revenge which De Gourges sought. He didn't have the necessary amount of people to take St. Augustine, or at least he thought he didn't. It would have been difficult. If he had been able to destroy St. Augustine, that would have ended Spanish Florida right then and there. Florida today, I would probably be speaking French to you, actually. So it's really amazing.
Absolutely stunning. And on top of it, what strikes me in this story is that, okay, they were deceived. They were basically commercial seamen looking for a way to make money. That's almost unbelievable that they could accomplish this. But even more unbelievable is that they were not Huguenots. They were just French Catholics. How did they feel a need to avenge the Huguenots?
Well, because they perceived it as an insult to France. And as de Gourges led the charge up to the fort, although that American Indian that I mentioned did go ahead of him and impale the Spaniard who was firing at them, de Gourges said that they were avenging France's honor and avenging the king. And the point was that even if their fellow French were Protestants who got killed, they were still French and they deserved to be avenged. And so that was his motivation and the motivation of the people who were sailing with him. They perceived what Spain did as an ethnic insult to them and a cultural insult, which of course it was. But the Spanish, like I said, were so wrapped up in their bizarre proposition nationalism, a very early form of it, that they had such a little concept of ethnic cohesion or, you know, a national culture that they just, you know, viewed these French as Lutherans, and that was that. But the French had a much more grounded conception of who they were as a people than the Spanish did. So when some of their fellow French died who had a different religion than them, they still thought that these are people who are basically our cousins and family must be avenged.
Wonderful. Eye for an eye, a true story of life, liberty, murder, and the pursuit of revenge at the birth of America. I've put the link to the Amazon book in the chat. Definitely, worth a read, and it's fascinating. It's like really you see the kind of Kill Bill movie that could be made out of these stories, at least one. In fact, someone has suggested in the chat a title for the movie. It would be called The Frenchman, and it would be it would be a ruthless Frenchman on a path of revenge.
Very fitting title, absolutely. And it's, you know, it deserves so much more attention than it's got, the events that I relate in the book. And it's very important, you know, not just because people need to obviously know the history of the New World, but it's important because what we see today with like the 1619 Project, and I devote a lot of a chapter to this, it's simply false history. We're taught that slavery in the U.S. began at this port in Virginia in 1619, and it was the English, blah, 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 and it was done as white supremacy, all the whites getting together to make life hard for the blacks, so on and so forth. In reality, it was done over half a century earlier. That's where it started, in Florida, by the Spaniards, who had just killed a bunch of whites who thought more of their fellow Catholics who were not white than their fellow whites who were not Catholic. And the Spaniards started this slave trade, despite not being able to have plantations of their own because the American Indians were coming after them. So it's really interesting. The whole 1619 narrative has been one of the most damaging, certainly to Western interests, that have been produced in recent memory. And it's an obvious BS narrative. And if people knew the truth of that, if they understood that the people who started slavery also enslaved their fellow whites and American Indians, it wasn't just this, you know, white on black thing done by the evil English. I think that a lot of people would be able to chill out more about the history of the New World. Of course, you know, a lot of people don't want to chill out, so they'll always find some reason to go nuts. But people do need to understand that the idea that the history of slavery in what's now America, the idea that it's as simple as they perceive it to be, that idea is just false.
Yeah, I was struck when I read that part of the book about the 1619 Project and slavery. I was struck by an argument that should be told to any of these woke leftists of today, which is if you want reparations to be paid, and if you claim that the richness of America and the wealth of America was built on the back of slaves, would you admit that you, even as a black person today, have then benefited from slavery? You have benefited because you claim that the whole country is built from slave work. Well, you are benefiting from the current country, so should you be paying reparation? And to who would you pay them? There's a problem, of course, in any discussion of reparation, that it's trying to correct an injustice toward people who are not here anymore to experience the relief.
Absolutely correct. And the reparations just don't work. I mean, for a host of reasons. I mean, obviously it's racial discrimination against whites, but basically anyone who's not black, that would include Asians, but it includes a whole bunch of people whose ancestors were not in the New World at the time of the slave trade. Or maybe people whose ancestors were abolitionists. It's a totally unworkable, unreasonable, irresponsible point of view, this reparation stuff. And part of me thinks it's not even intended to happen. I think it's just a tool that a lot of people on the left are using to agitate against whites and perhaps Asians at this point too, as a means of creating a more angry, militant form of leftism that gratifies the passions of progressives who in the West are becoming more and more unhinged. I mean, a lot of these people have no idea what the history of their own family is, let alone the history of their country, but they just want to be angry about something. And reparations definitely are a good flashpoint for anger.
Absolutely. Now, as a last question, as a libertarian, I'm very interested to determine where and when can we see something like the birth of America again? Of course, not in America, but perhaps save some spirit of liberty that has animated Absolutely. This country for hundreds of years. Can we take the model of your book, which basically states there's a parallel between the English America that has risen and led to this Protestant culture, work ethics, production, business, and liberty? And it also happened to the French. Therefore, can we generalize and extrapolate? Can we find what could be a future for a new birth of a new free country from what happened to the French and then the English in America?
All that's needed for this, it definitely, as a matter of fact, I think it will happen. I don't think that it can happen. I think it will happen. All that's needed is some land that you don't even need a lot of it, just land that's not developed in a country that is very immigrant friendly. It'd have to be somewhere in the third world, obviously, that would let a bunch of people who want to create something that would be a benefit to the country they find themselves in exist. So this government, I think as most third world governments probably would have to be okay with these newcomers building their own town, village on this undeveloped land. I don't think it's terrible difficult for people from the West to find something like this. There are places in the Caribbean, there are places in Latin America, there are, you know, places in Asia as well, even in Africa. But the thing of it is that people, there have to be several thousand Westerners who decide enough is enough, we're leaving where we are now, and we're going to reclaim the pioneer spirit of our forefathers. I think that as times grow bad enough in the West, and they'll get much worse, I'd say, I think this will happen. And as you see in the book, you don't need a lot of people. The French didn't even have a lot of land. They just had this little plot along a river that they wanted to create their own town in, and they wanted to get along well with everyone else. So these Westerners who want to build a new Western civilization, or really just reclaim an old one, they would have to be accustomed to living on not too much land, but enough that they have breathing room. And they'd also be willing to get along with their neighbors, who are obviously going to be very different from them. But it can be done. It definitely can be done. And the Huguenots did show how Westerners can be strangers in a strange land, but build a society that works well with the natives. The only reason that French Florida really, you know, went up in flames is because of the French, the fellow Westerners of the French, the Spanish, who decided to destroy it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sure. I think that in time, Westerners will leave Canada, the U.S., other places, and there will be like colonies they set up in the undeveloped world, and you will see a renaissance of traditional Western culture in these places. It's not going to be most Westerners, obviously, who decide to leave for the, you know, for a pioneer life. But I think it will happen. There's plenty of undeveloped land. There are a lot of countries that'd be willing to take these people in. A lot of people think that, you know, third world countries don't like whites, but that's not true. A lot of third world countries actually are desperate for European immigration because they recognize that's an economic, it's economically vigorous for them. So, you know, there are countries are out there. There just have to be several thousand Westerners who decide, you know, we don't like the way things are going here. And we're going to try to reclaim our forefathers' pioneer spirit. I think, you know, I'm not a man who likes to speak in certainties about the future, but I think something like this is basically destined to happen. I don't know where or when the colony will be, but I think that it absolutely can take place. And the roadmap, which the Huguenots set out, is absolutely worth following.
Fascinating. So we need a breakaway event, an event of self-selection for people who have that kind of spirit. And then I would argue, also implicit to what you described, you need basically a welcoming population that is maybe, I don't know if the word is warranted or judgmental, but somehow a backwards population that has a lot of benefit to gain from the incoming migrants, the way Native Americans had some benefits to gain from the arrival of the French.
Without question. You know, a lot of Westerners thought that this place was going to be the Ukraine. And that's why a lot of Americans and Canadians were moving there. But the way it works is that just because a place is poor doesn't mean that it's someplace that, you know, you could find the life you want for cheap. Very often these countries, even though they have lower cost of living, come with some extremely high expenses, such as, you know, a thugocracy running your life, which is what you get in a lot of Eastern Europe. But yeah, the countries that the Westerners would run to, it wouldn't be in Eastern Europe or anything like that. It would be in places that are really underdeveloped, like parts of Latin America, Asia, some of Africa, and they would have to have a government that is not very powerful, that, you know, is just willing to have them there because they are economically prosperous, these newcomers. There are many such places. I don't know which one will actually be the host to this new colony, but I'm certain that this colony can be built. I don't know who will build it, but I think that will probably happen within both of our lifetimes, because at the end of the day, the way things are going in the West, there are a lot of people who in America think that the country could have the clock turned back to, say, the 1980s or even the 1950s. As you and I both know, that's not happening. The only thing people can really do is move someplace that's more attuned to their personal preferences. And it's, for a lot of people, this means that they're going to have to build that place or to go someplace perhaps that's already there, but they're going to have to accept a lower standard of living and for themselves and their posterity, build up something that is going to stand the test of time. They need others of like mind to do the same. So there's always, you know, there's something unique to Westerners, a real pioneer spirit. And you saw this among the French Huguenots, and you certainly saw it among the British, whether they're English, Welsh, Scottish, or Irish. And, you know, a lot of Westerners, I think, are just predisposed to going to the great unknown and constructing something something important for themselves and for the future.
And whenever that happens, we must remind a slogan that we have learned from your book and from the general history that you told: never again, never let the Spanish in. Protect this new place of liberty.
A lot of Spanish probably want to leave Spain. It's crazy how things, you know, just come, I guess, come 180. But yes, they want to leave Spain today, not because they want to colonize the world for Spain. They want to leave Spain because they're scared of getting colonized by their own country. It's really crazy.
But so many repeating schemes in history. It's fascinating.
Without doubt. And I do think that it's important to talk about one thing here. Proposition nationalism, which you and I, you know, we've heard this term used quite a bit, it fails. It failed the Spanish. Their empire fell apart eventually. It was supplanted by the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, and the British. The Spanish largely fell apart because they did not have a strong culture and identity. All they had was their religion, which, like civic nationalism of today, is intended to give people values that they adhere to, creating a really artificial unity. Meanwhile, these people don't even necessarily share the same language. So proposition nationalism is something that sounds nice, it sounds humane, but in reality, it's just a set of ideas that are far more abstract, immaterial, and quite frankly, uninspiring than a group of people who share a common history, heritage, and culture, a common origin. That's how, over the long run, you can bind a community and make it withstand serious problems. So, yeah, proposition nationalism is something that the Spaniards tried and led to bloodshed. The U.S. has proposition nationalism for its empire, and obviously that's caused a lot of bloodshed in places where it's been exported to, whether it's the Middle East or the Ukraine or some parts of Latin America. So a good takeaway from this book, even though I don't mention proposition nationalism in it, but I think people can read between the lines and see that, you know, in addition to many other mistakes of history, some of which are detailed in Eye for an Eye, proposition nationalism is nothing that is a very good idea, nothing worth pursuing.
Ideas are too unbinding. You can take the principles of America and you can live by them, or you can loosely connect with them like many Americans today do, or you can even hate them. That's the big problem. Proposition nationalism leads to such a diversity of attitudes that basically it binds no one.
Absolutely. And it's possible, obviously, to have a society which is quite homogenous, but at the same time focused on individual rights and liberties, as the Huguenots showed. But it has to be a society that, number one, is not wanting to become an empire. That's the most important thing. Number two, it has to be something that recognizes that people are going to live differently, so you have to let them be. And number three, it has to realize that the way to bind people together who are different is not through, you know, forcing a certain way of life on them. It starts with words of liberty, such as Uncle Sam says, that it ends with drone strikes on civilians. But the way to do it is through commerce and trade. That does build tolerance and prosperity and cooperation and diverse peoples who will never be, you know, the same, but they'll still be able to get along all the same. They will learn to appreciate each other and I think have a very healthy relationship.
All right, Joseph Cotto, I have to continue the show solo because I have a couple of announcements. It was a great pleasure talking to you, and what an amazing book, Eye for an Eye. It's kind of subversive as a book because it's not an ideological book at all. And yet, just thinking about these historical things that you present in fine detail, it naturally leads the brain to a path of thinking about these very important ideas and broad questions about American society and how it came to be. So absolutely fascinating how you do it.
Thank you.
It's quite subtle, actually. You have to read the book and then you're struck by the details and all, and then you have to kind of take it in, and it takes a couple of hours before you realize what was inserted in your mind.
Thank you. Yeah, the book was intended to be, you know, something that speaks to people of different political backgrounds, but it certainly has many lessons, as I say, about the reality of human nature and politics and culture and diversity. And it's very important, I think, for people to read the book and learn these lessons for themselves, not by having these lessons, you know, bashed over. They shouldn't be bashed over the head with these lessons, but they could see how history played out. And I think they could figure out what is the best course of action in the present and the future. So, yeah, and JF, thank you very much, by the way, for inviting me on your show. It's a great honor to be here, as it has been a great honor in the past. I only regret that I had this wobbly camera for the first few minutes, but I think that was taken care of.
Yes, well taken care of. Thank you so much, Joseph, and see you soon.
Absolutely, JF. Take it easy. Have a great night to you and your audience.
Bye-bye. All right, Joseph Cotto, what an amazing guy and a great writer, very engaging. It's not my style of writing. When you read the JF book, it's all logical and it's all about the structure of ideas. Joseph Cotto is a man of facts, and it's quite impressive to see him go from the little and the facts of the world, which I don't write at all about facts. I mean, if you've read The Revolutionary Phenotype, you know that I'm all about structure of ideas and how do we think of this. And Joseph Cotto is like, how did it happen first? And then we can talk maybe a little bit about the lessons that we can drag from it, but he approaches ideas from a much more empirical and natural perspective. He lets it come to your mind And that is absolutely a style of writing that is fascinating for me to read. Although I wouldn't write this, I wouldn't, because as a scientist, you know, a guy of hard science and even theoretical science, in front of a historical fact, I'm like, is that true or is that what this guy says? Is that true or is that what this guy claims? Or is that this guy's perspective? I'm like, I don't even know that I believe in a single historical fact ever because I'm always doubting stuff. And so I kind of find a refuge in the world of ideas and in the world of axioms. But Joseph Coteau is a man of the Floridian swamps, and he is also a man of the historical swamp. He doesn't mind getting into the weeds and sorting out the details of factual reality. I wanted to do an announcement. I will be on Saturday in a debate, modern day debate. Modern day debate wants me to be in a tag team. So I will be with the atheist T-Jump, who I've been finding weak when he faced Nadir. But I know that he's an intelligent guy and a sensical guy, so I'll be on his side defending on the question of what is scientific evidence pointing to, theism or atheism, what is the favored model of the universe, and so I'll be on the side of atheism. And I'll be facing... let me see here in the email. I will be facing Saul Cordova and perspective philosophy. Oh my god, perspective philosophy. I've already debated him. He's quite the slimy creature in terms of a debater. always with his loose references to abstract philosophical concepts and always sliding away from truly saying anything. Oh my god. And he's going to be combined with a guy that I don't know about, but his name is Saul Cordova, who apparently has been writing blogs like this on evolution is wrong, evolution has been proven wrong, the neo-Darwinists have been totally failing. It's going to be funny to have this combination of a guy who basically claims that science has proven Darwin wrong, like with his specific scientific claims, and then perspective philosophy, basically a poet, even claiming that perspective philosophy is a poet is to give a little too much credit, because you know, poems have structure. They have a certain number of syllables per line. Perspective philosophy is the absolute definition of a lack of thing, a lack of structure. It's going to be a shit show, quite fun. Don't miss it. It's going to be Saturday, next Saturday, the 24th. Is it Saturday? Let me just give you the right date to be sure. I don't want to mislead. Where is the email? There it is. It will be Saturday the 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Silver Spider says, Neo-Darwinist wrecked, lol. Yes, it's what a lot will be. A lot of creationists and anti-science people are specializing in that sort of debate where they will claim that somehow there was a very important part of Darwin's theory and it was proven wrong. And really, it sucks, but the way to debate against this is to point out a much more broad vision of what biology is. And very often, these guys will go autistically on a single principle of evolution, and not even a principle, just something that was just thought out by some evolutionist, and they say, that is wrong, that is wrong. But yeah, the whole edifice of the theory of evolution doesn't fall, even if that was wrong, because the theory of evolution is a very simple statement. that cannot be undermined by any mathematical specific claim of the kind, oh, the Fisher's theory of the Fisher's principle of natural selection is false sometimes. Well, that doesn't change anything. It doesn't change anything as to it relates to natural selection being true. FINA approves gender inclusion policy for transgender swimmers. That is actually good news. Because they say they are now accepting for the swimmers transgender people. But they have set new standards. And these standards are basically... there's a mix of a good news and a bad news here. The standards are making it such that if you have gone through any part of your puberty as your biological sex, you cannot compete in the woman category. A Silver Spider says buffering. I'm so sorry. It seems that it's been a repeated problem on Odyssey's part. Hopefully they find a quick way to resolve it. It's been okay, the buffering, for a couple of days. And then before that, there was a problem, and now there's a problem. So, the transgender swimmers will have to prove that they haven't gone through a single minute of their puberty, which basically means they will have to prove that they have undergone sex change surgery and hormone therapy before being 12 years old. So basically, that for most cases, this means transgender people will not be able to go compete. Transgender, you know, male to female people will not be able to compete in the female category. Now, the bad news is I don't want to live in a world where this is being used as an argument to push for younger and younger sex transition, because then you're going to have people start arguing, well, I need to change my sex at 10 years old because I want to be part of the swimming competition in my body as a woman. So it can go both ways. On the one hand, it will give a chance for fairness to female adult swimmers to be competing with other females. But on the other hand, in the long term, I'm afraid that such a rule will actually motivate and justify younger and younger transitioning of sex. Delcroix says, no buffering all night, great chat. Okay, so well, that's great. For some people, the buffering issue doesn't seem to affect. Silver Spider, perhaps you might try to lower the quality of the bandwidth. You know, there's if you refresh, you'll see an option to put it at 480p. That will maybe reduce the resolution, reduce the bandwidth, and perhaps you won't have a buffering problem. Someone was asking me, JF, is that true? And on top of it, he sent me this article, which is dated in the future. It's dated to be released by Scientific American on July 1st, 2022. So somehow it's already on the internet. And it's the question how parents' trauma leaves biological traces in children. This is the whole epigenetics idea. The idea that your genes contain some annotation, and it's not part of the gene, but it's an annotation, it's a little molecule that flags a certain gene. And these annotations are meant to have the body react differently to this gene, where perhaps some annotation will make a gene turn on more or turn off more. And the idea is that this is irritable, and therefore there is a parallel system of inheritance to genes, where if a mother, for example, would have undergone some stress during the pregnancy, the child would be born with the marks on his DNA, the annotations that say, be stressed, the environment is dangerous, be stressed. It's better to be stressed to survive. I think the system has been demonstrated to exist, so I don't believe that epigenetics is false. It exists, but it's systematically overplayed. We still don't have a clue of the amount of total behavioral variability in humans that can be explained by epigenetics. And just to give you a rough approximation, based on current data, we cannot tell you that it's more than 0.0001% of human behaviors that are influenced by epigenetics. So next time someone tries to bring this to your attention, the way to respond to the epigenetics people is to say, I'm very enthusiastic about what you're talking to me about. Now tell me, how much of the total human behaviors, everything we can observe and everything that humans end up doing or not doing, how much of a percentage of this is influenced by epigenetics? And if they answer anything above 0.0001%, ask for proof of this. Because the epigenetics people, they're trying to present something which really is not genetic inheritance as a kind of pushover of genetic inheritance, as a kind of something that comes to replace and kind of displace genetic inheritance as central to biology. And it doesn't do that. In fact, the big problem is to have called all of this epigenetics. It shouldn't have been called epigenetics. It should have been called phenotypic variation, because that is what it is. You know, a mother will produce some degree of milk, and in certain environments will produce more milk or less milk, or more quality milk or less quality milk. And no one would think of this as being the inheritance of genes across generation. No one would think of calling this epigenetics. We would just call this environment variability and phenotypic variability. And yet, the woman who's breastfeeding and who's feeding things of various quality to her child is effectively doing the exact same as epigenetics. It's transferring a signal from the last generation to the next generation, except that it's not genes, it's the phenotype, and really it will boil down to how humans have evolved to respond both to the DNA annotations that epigenetics talks of and to the nutrients in milk of their mother. None of it should be considered anyhow parallel to the idea of genes and replicators as central to the theory of evolution. What else did I want to talk about? NASA rover found some space trash on Mars. I love that they come directly with the with the conclusion that it's space trash and we should rethink how we are polluting space with pieces of metal like this, because look at what we just found on Mars. Because somehow when I saw this picture, I thought of a parallel universe in which we don't reach that conclusion. Imagine that we see this and we say, there's life on Mars. Instead of saying there's litter on Mars. I mean, who knows? How do you know that this is from a human civilization rather than from an extraterrestrial civilization? Well, they say it's foil thermal blanket. So very interesting, because it's something that is typically used by spacecraft, human spacecraft. So I guess that is a beginning of an answer. But it's quite interesting that it is this thing that made it to Mars. Is it from a probe that was sent in the direction of Mars? Or is it from a Earth-rotating satellite that lost a piece of it? Because I'm interested in how much did that thing have to travel, and how did it travel? Did it rip apart from a spacecraft very close to Mars? Or did it rip apart from a Earth-based spacecraft and traveled all the way because it is light? Well, the fact that it's light, of course, in space will allow it to accelerate quicker from a push. Like if there was some kind of air leak that pushed this foil out, it would go faster than a heavy material because the heavy material will accelerate less. So why is it that foil made it onto Mars? I would love to know. And I wanted to review as a last news item, the Solana community with the Soland people. I've talked about it on the show earlier in another show. They have voted for a big whale who was engaged in a very risky position. Basically, the whale was holding millions of dollars of Solana coins and was betting that Solana would not drop below $20. And if it would drop below $20, then the automated smart chain would basically lead to him being liquidated, and therefore $170 million of his Solana would be sold on the market, which would result in a market crash. And so somehow, in total violation of crypto principles, the Solend community voted to appropriate his coins and to sell them themselves as a way to liquidate him. An absolute violation of the idea of DeFi and the whole idea that there is no authority that can take over your wallet. They just decided by vote, all right, this guy is too big and too dangerous, we're taking his wallet. Stunningly. And look at the kind of justification that they've published. This is from the Solend Protocol Twitter account. They say, hey guys, I'm 6HFX, so that's a voter with a big amount of weight, I guess, in the democracy of Solend. He says, I'm planning to vote yes on the second proposal. I don't care about crypto Twitter hate if that means salvaging $120 million of retail order instead of holding up DeFi ethos for some whale that is degenerately gambling away nine-figure positions. With power comes responsibility, and the whale is showing none. But if we can work out a better solution, and it seems like the market is giving us a bit of time, I think I'm in favor of SLND2. We need to be quick with SLND3, though. Thing can look very different in 24 hours already. Holy shit. This kind of moralizing, this kind... I didn't know it would come to the blockchain, and here we are. It's like, oh, we have to take this guy's wealth because he's being irresponsible, and with great power comes great responsibility. So here, I'm taking your stuff. I didn't think it would come. Definitely, to me, this means the end of Solana, the end of Solend. I never own these things anyway. I don't trust these... Alternative blockchains. Listen, it's the first crypto community that I see by vote appropriate against their own structure of their smart contracts. They decided to appropriate and force a sale of someone else's wallet. The shit that this is to me, the pile of shit that this looks like to me, I hope that in the future the Solana community becomes so punished that eventually people end up saying never again, like never do what Solana did, because I hope they are worth 1 cent in 1 year from now. I hope that everyone says no. Don't buy Solana, they can take away your cash through vote. I don't think that this will ever come to the Bitcoin blockchain. I think there is kind of a principle on the Bitcoin blockchain that you don't do that, but I hope it never does. It's so scary. Deadstar has sent a super chat. He says, what is the best element on the periodic table? Well. Periodic table. It's been a while, I haven't looked at it, so... But I remember having my favorite, so let me look at it to refresh my memory. Of course, there's always the rare gases, but you know, they call them the noble gases. It's always in your head that there is something noble to the right of the table of elements. But at the same time, if you know anything about chemistry, you know that those are the least interesting elements because they lead to the least possible amount of chemical bonding with other things. So they're really noble, but to the point of being boring. And so I disqualify the noble gas, although I have some admiration for the purity of them. In the end, they are just good to pass light through and to get some fluorescent result like neon. Or argon, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, but argon has been used in windows, apparently. It can create a layer of invisible material, so it stays a window, but it's also heat filtering. It provides a good insulation to window. But I'm not sure, is it argon or am I being confused here? Anyways, those are disqualified from my favorite element potential. Of course, then you have where is gold? Gold should be somewhere. Oh my god, the thing is, this is the table in English. And I believe, yeah, okay, there it is. No, it's not that the icons change, the letters remain the same for the French symbol, but somehow I'm confused about finding myself. So there it is, I found copper, silver, gold. This trio right here made me dream a lot when I was young, because I was like, well, you're telling me that three very important and rare and valuable metals are somehow related to each other, you know? This is not so different than this, and this is not so different than this. Of course, then you have to understand that the difference is still major, because although they have the same amount of electrons on their outer shell in the standard, high school model of the atom, they differ by massive amounts of protons and neutrons in the nucleus. But somehow, as a child, I was looking at this and dreaming, there's probably something we can do to turn copper into silver, and there's probably something we can do to turn silver into gold. I had the dream, and then there were all these legends of people attempting to produce gold from nothing, and all of them failing, of course. But the fact that they were aligned, now I realize that it really gives them a very interesting property, which is the transmission of electricity. That's why copper is used for electrical cable and gold is used in certain electronic components. It's because being at this position in the periodic table of the elements gives you high electrical conductivity. But because I've been denied my dream of creating gold from copper, I cannot choose them as my favorite elements. And then, of course, as a farmer, I know that something here is important. You need phosphorus in your garden. You need nitrogen. And of course, we don't say it because we don't use them as fertilizers, but you need carbon, oxygen. So I know that life happens here. And also you need potassium. And so I know that life needs these things, and I know that carbon is ultimately very important for what life became on Earth. But I cannot specially like the carbon, because I know that life is great, but carbon is not what makes it great. Because I know that when you burn life, you obtain truly pure carbon, like charcoal. And to me, it's a black thing that's useless. And I mean, you can use it to just further burn. But so I'm not fascinated by carbon, although I'm fascinated by the life that it can build in. And of course, some proper mention must be made of where is it? What is there lead on there? Where is lead? Where is lead on the periodic table? There it is, PB. PB, so it's right here. I'm going to declare PB as my favorite element. Because PB shows lead is the heaviest, I believe, element by density. And not the heaviest by nuclear count, but heaviest in terms of how much it weighs per volume. Or perhaps this one is, I don't know. Lead is the point of convergence of fusion and fission reactions. Somehow, the nuclear sizes above it converge back down to it, and the nuclear sizes smaller than it converge up to it. There is something central about lead. It's kind of the center of nature. It's as much a center as nature could point to. There's nothing really, you know, you look at, is there a center to the earth? Well, if you go micro, you're going to start hesitating, is the center here or the center here? Is there a center to the sun? Maybe it's here, maybe it's here. Lead is a true center of nature, a true binary division of the nuclear world in the smaller items that are more unstable and the bigger items that are more unstable. Fractal Man says it absolutely beautifully. I think it captures what I see in lead. It's the radioactive dead end. That is beautifully said. That is... Dino Legovic says, lead is just shit left over after fission has left the building. Exactly. Exactly. So somehow it's the highest nuclei count that is stable enough not to be radioactive. So I like it. I will declare it the winner. Silver Spider has sent a super chat. Thank you so much for supporting the show. He says, hey JF, at our last ultrasound, it was discovered our baby, while having a 72 percentile head circumference, has a more than 95 percentile biparietal diameter. My wife and I both measured our heads, and it turns out we are more than 95 percentile in head circumference. Doctor says no abnormalities. Thoughts? I think there's no abnormality, and it's only good news. I think you may have the potential for your son to be a genius if he has overdeveloped parietal areas. Those will make him... He's got a chance at being a super geometric genius of some kind. So just educate him well, but like you would have educated a less... a child with a smaller head also well, but pay particular attention at introducing him to Euclidean geometry very early and abstract mathematics and advanced mathematics, and perhaps he's going to become a trailblazer in science, who knows. That is it for tonight, boys. If you would like to support the show, join the Patreon or the Subscribestar. Or you can also send one-off super chats through Subscribestar, Odyssey, as well as Entropy Offline. Much love to all of you, and I will see you all tomorrow. Thank you.